The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to another wonderful evening at the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Morris Williams, and it's my privilege to welcome you to what is going to be just an exciting exploration of science, of art, and of curiosity. And please, when you talk to your children, or even for yourselves, remember curiosity. That's a keystone of what Leonardo da Vinci was all about. Please remember to turn off your cell phones. Please remember no flash photography. Please remember that the Free Library is benefiting from the expansion of the branch system. Four new branches have been remodeled and redone. There's an article in the Inquirer last Sunday that I hope you saw. And if you walk out through the exit, you'll be able to look through a picture window into work that's going on here that will be finished in another year when you come back. There will be a book signing tonight. In terms of adding new information to what's contained in your program, you might be interested to know that for someone that is on a book tour, Walter Isaacson was in Fort Worth last night. He did three events, and this is the third event that he's done in Philadelphia today. And tomorrow he's in Toronto. So it is a challenge in terms of, but it's a wonderful book that you will enjoy, not only because of the content, but the paper quality of this book is the highest, which means that all of the art and all of the drawings that Leonardo da Vinci did and that are published is just an outstanding part of that. Walter Isaacson is a native of New Orleans, and he now makes New Orleans his home. He now teaches a course at Tulane University in, surprisingly enough, Innovation, which of course was a wonderful book that he did some years ago. He's also now on the New Orleans City Planning Commission, so I know that they'll have good results from that. One other piece of information that's not in your program but you might be curious to know is that Paramount has bought the film rights to Leonardo da Vinci. And would you be interested to know that the film is being crafted as, quote, a star vehicle for Leonardo DiCaprio to play the lead? One other note that I will just make as a personal appeal. You know, we hear every day about a tax cut that's coming, and presumably many of us will benefit from it. May I suggest that you take 10-20% of that tax cut and contribute it to the Free Library of Philadelphia or to other worthy arts organizations that need our support so that we have the opportunity to promote curiosity, to promote learning, to promote the intersection of science, technology, and philosophy, art, paintings. And without further ado, let's give a warm Philadelphia welcome to a man who combines all of the genius qualities that are in his book. Ladies and gentlemen, Walter Isaacson.
Thank you, Morris. It is really good to be back in this room and back in this library. By the way, if you ever write a biography of Benjamin Franklin, you never lack for invitations to Philadelphia, but that is a great reason to write a bio of Franklin, because this is one of my favorite cities. It's a city that connects commerce, engineering, creativity, and the arts. It's why the computer was invented here. It's why Ben Franklin ran away from Boston in order to be here. And it's because of the inspiration of Benjamin Franklin when I wrote about him that led me eventually to Leonardo da Vinci. Because the cool thing about Benjamin Franklin is not that he was a particularly good diplomat or just a great electricity experimenter or just a great writer, author, statesman. It's that he loved all disciplines. He was curious about everything. And his creativity came from seeing the patterns of nature. He would go up and down the coast when he formed the U.S. Postal Service and look at the whirlwinds and make his horse ride in the whirlwind so he could see that pattern of a spiral. And then he understands how Northeasterners work, Northeastern storms. They don't come from the Northeast, he realized. They come up the coast. And then he discovers the Gulf Stream because he feels patterns of nature. And as you'll see, the person who embodies that most in all of history is Leonardo da Vinci. Leonardo had the great good fortune to be born out of wedlock. In this tiny town of Vinci, had he been born otherwise, he would have been a notary, like his father, grandfather, great-grandfather, and great-great-grandfather. Leonardo always loved to blur the line between reality and imagination. He always loved to push things a little bit further, to experiment, to procrastinate at times, and sometimes put things aside for a long period so he could perfect them later. These are wonderful qualities for an innovator, but they don't make for a very good notary. He would have been particularly bad. But he was lucky. As he grew up in Vinci, not being able to go to school, he decided to teach himself everything you could possibly learn. And in this little village, you can see the streams that go down to the Arno River. He put little obstacles in the stream. And like Benjamin Franklin, he loved that pattern of spiraling water. And he asked himself, why does water, when it goes from a larger channel to a smaller one, form a spiral? He asked himself, why is the sky blue? Or why do fish swim faster in water than birds can fly in air when water is heavier? In other words, he was a typical 10-year-old, curious about everything possible. He even writes in his notebooks at one point, describe the tongue of the woodpecker. I go, whoa, who would wake up one morning and really want to know what the tongue? You don't need it to paint a painting of a bird or do the flight of birds or engineering. He needed it because he was Leonardo. And he was interested, I mean, how would you even find out? But he was interested in everything. We're all that way when we're 10 or 12, and then we outgrow our wonder years. One of the secrets of Leonardo da Vinci is that he never outgrew his wonder years. He always, every week in his notebooks, listed a set of questions, some pretty mundane or ordinary, that were things that we see every day. But he was interested in the phenomenon, and he'd say, let me discover it. Let me be a disciple of experience. His father brought him to Florence when, in about 1470 or late 1460s, when Leonardo is just turning 12. And it's a great place for Leonardo da Vinci. First of all, the printing press had just spread and been discovered, but in Florence they had cloth merchants, so they had a lot of rag paper. And so they had good quality paper, and so, like the Free Library of Philadelphia, there were always books to be found. In Leonardo's notebook, we see things like, go to the stationers by the bridge, where they have a copy translated of Euclid, or the anatomies he wanted to study, or the poetry and the bawdy plays that he loved. He buys 400 books when he's just in his 20s. It's also a place, like Philadelphia was, especially at the beginning of the digital revolution, that combined all sorts of arts and sciences. There were jewelry makers who worked with cloth merchants, who worked with chemists, and they're inventing new types of silk. There were mathematicians who worked with architects and artists, and they're inventing the science of perspective, but also the art of debit and credit bookkeeping. So great banking families can figure out venture capital, and the Medici become the behind-the-scenes force. So everything is being invented, from commerce to finance to art, to engineering, to chemistry, all in a republic that's extraordinarily tolerant. Just like when Ben Franklin lands at the end of Market Street and marches up the street, and he's surprised to find a city of brotherly love in which there, everything from, Moravians and Jews and slaves and freed slaves and Anglicans and people from all over in Philadelphia living together, so too in Florence, a kid like Leonardo, who was a bit of a misfit, could fit right in. Leonardo was not only illegitimate, he was gay, he was left-handed, he was a bit of a heretic, for a while he's a vegetarian, and yet everybody loves him in the village of, in this town of Florence. He's known as a good-looking, likable kid who can do everything. In fact, we know exactly what he does look like because he goes to work in the studio of Andrea Verrocchio, one of the big studios in Florence. And Verrocchio himself is a sculptor and does the sculpture on the left of David. But in one of the notebooks from that period, we can find the new apprentice, Leonardo da Vinci, in the middle there, posing for the statue of David. So we know he's as good looking as everybody said he was. He's also at a studio, a Verrocchio studio, and people have written about Leonardo, call it an art studio. That doesn't do it justice. One of the great things about the studios of Florence is they did everything. For example, in Florence, on everybody knows Brunelleschi's dome on the wonderful cathedral. But if you remember, there's a copper ball there. And one of the first things Leonardo does when he becomes an apprentice in the studio is he's on the team that solders the copper ball and puts it on top of the Duomo, all with the mechanisms they'll do it up. Curved mirrors to capture the rays of the sun, because that's how you had to solder copper, and making it exactly proportional so it fit in with Brunelleschi's dome. It is early on that combination of art and engineering, or to be more precise, a guy who doesn't make a distinction between art and engineering and loves it all. The other things he does as a young apprentice in the studio is he helps with pageants and plays. I think historians have underestimated the fact that public spectacles, parades, pageants, wonderful, public plays, that was the main form of entertainment back in the Renaissance before TV and movies. And the first drawing we have of Leonardo, the old craggy warrior, one of his favorite types, and then the young warrior done by Verrocchio, they were actually costumes for a pageant that was celebrating a visit of the Duke of Milan. And you see with Leonardo the very carefully observed, scientifically accurate wings of a bat, but also things like dragons and, of course, the famous swirls that he loves, the curls he always uses, lions. It is a mixture of fantasy and reality that comes from being a theater producer. In fact, one of the most famous things we know him for is, didn't he invent the helicopter, this drawing? Yes, he imagined it, but this started as a prop, an ingenious device for a play to bring the angels down from the rafters in the performance of Danae. But the cool thing about Leonardo is that whenever he let his imagination roam, he decided to see if he could apply his imagination. And so for the rest of his life, he's looking for ways, as you know, to build flying machines. And eventually, imagination does catch up. Things like helicopters are built. But, of course, he is also a painter. And in this, one of the earliest paintings he works on, it's in Verrocchio's shop. Most of it is done by Verrocchio, but Leonardo does the angel on the left and the background, and it reminds us that back then, being an artist wasn't some solo endeavor where you went to a garret, did a painting and signed it. It was a collaborative endeavor, like making a computer in Philadelphia. It was a collaborative endeavor. That creativity was a team sport. So we have, in a lot of Leonardo's paintings, we know there are parts of it painted by others in the studio. This is the first time he does some painting And he does something that's a motif from his childhood to his deathbed, which is the swirling, curling of water, and a metaphor in which the curls of a river and water connect us to the eons of the ancient geological past, you know, mountains that are mysterious and mystical in their geological ancient nature, curving all around and connecting us to the earth. In this case, very literally, because John the Baptist is pouring the water of the River Jordan over Jesus. And in particular, if you look at the water, and I know people laughed at Morris for saying the high-quality paper, but this is one reason I wanted it on that very high-quality art stock paper. You have to look at the ripples around the ankles of Jesus and how exactly scientific they're accurate they are, including the fossil formations and sedimentary layers. But the way water passes an obstacle, he always loves that. The other thing he's so great at throughout his life is showing how inner emotion can get translated into outward expressions and gestures. This is one of his great contributions to the Renaissance art. And he does it because he walks around town with his notebooks and sees people, you know, with their facial expressions and tries to imagine their inner emotions. Or he sees somebody who's having some emotional experience and takes note of their gestures and expressions. And here on his angel, in three quarters profile, twisting a bit, just landing, feeling like he's in motion. But the expressiveness of emotions on his face as he looks up at Jesus, it's something you hadn't seen before in art, which is inner emotions welling up and being expressed on a face, sometimes mysteriously. This is Verrocchio's angel, and it only has one emotion on its face, which is, how did I get here next to this most amazing angel? His first painting that he does himself is Ginevra da Benci, which you can see in the National Gallery in Washington. Once again, as always, from the ancient eons of time, we are connected to creation. The river flows and connects into our veins. This is the wife of a cloth merchant in Florence. In three quarters profile, with somewhat mysterious expressions and feelings and emotions on her face. But it's not that great. Eyelids are a bit heavy, whatever. At the end of his life, he would also do the wife of a Florence cloth merchant in three quarters profile with emotions on her face. This is not the Mona Lisa, but this is clearly the painting of the young guy who's going to go on and paint the Mona Lisa. Kenneth Clark and some of the other great art scholars who wrote about Leonardo in the 20th century say things like, it's a shame he wasted so much time on philosophy and geology and anatomy and math and connecting the earth to the cosmos and stuff, because had he not been so distracted by those things, he would have painted more paintings. That's probably true, but he would have probably painted more paintings like Ginevra da Benci, a lifetime spent being curious about everything there was to know about nature, including how we fit into it, is what gets you from painting Ginevra da Benci to the Mona Lisa. He also translates his stage drama into his paintings. This is Adoration of the Magi, and you can see it's that swirl he loves, but it's a dramatic scene. It's not just one moment. It's the second king giving the gift. The first king is then bowing down, and each person along the spiral is reacting to the person before as if you're looking at a narrative. Even the shadows and light help color the person next in the narrative. It becomes very complicated, and he doesn't finish it. That's one of the downsides, maybe, of Leonardo. When he can't perfect something, he puts it aside. For example, also in that period, he does St. Jerome in the Wilderness. He can't get the neck muscles right when he first does it. He has them wrong in sort of the prep drawings and other things. It's 25 years later that he actually does anatomy, and he dissects the human body, including every muscle in the face, the neck, and other places. And he goes back to this painting, which he had left with Amerigo Vespucci's family, Agostino Vespucci, the cousin of the guy who sort of discovers America. And he goes back to this painting and gets the neck muscles right. So it's not so much that he gives up on paintings. It's just that every now and then he thinks, all right, there'll still be a brushstroke I can do. Some way I can perfect it. I approached all this not like the art historians who've written about Leonardo by looking at his 15 or so masterpieces, but through his notebooks, because there are more than 7,200 pages of his notebooks still out there. And, you know, they're not all gathered in one place, so it's an arduous task to have to go find them. They're in Venice and Florence and Paris and London and Rome. So Kathy and I spent time in all those places. And we were upstairs at dinner just recently, a little while ago, talking about Free Library of Philadelphia and stuff, and how paper is actually a wonderful information storage technology. 500 years later, we can still flip through the pages of Leonardo's notebooks. I couldn't, with Steve Jobs, he couldn't retrieve his memos and emails from the 1990s because the operating system of the next computer wasn't working still. But paper, the operating system never goes out of style. One of the things that amuses me, because it came up at dinner, is we were talking about how great libraries 10 years ago started saying, we have to digitize everything. We have to make sure all of our things are digital. And that's true. It's good. It makes it accessible. But one of the things that's happening now is we're taking all of our digital stuff, our emails, our Facebook posts, our tweets, and our memos that are in our computers, and people are figuring out the best way to save them is print them out on high-quality paper and put them in a volume where 500 years later people can still flip through them. On just any one notebook page, you can see his mind dancing with nature, leaping around to different things like the craggy old warrior he loves so much. But right here is a tree growing into the torso of the warrior because Leonardo has just sort of figured out a law of branching, now called Leonardo's Law, which is when a trunk of a tree branches, the cross-sectional areas of each of the branches add up to the cross-section of the trunk. Well, that's interesting, but Leonardo, as usual, sees it a pattern in nature because he realizes from his dissections that it's true of the veins and arteries in a human, a branch, and the tributaries of a river. So he sort of, as he's thinking it through, shows the tree flowing into the torso. He's doing other things, like those curls of water that he loves so much, and comparing them to curls of hair, and saying they have the same spiral pattern, even doing a stab at the math of it, Fibonacci's equation. Also doing the math of something called, you know, the transformation of shapes, how you take a shape, one shape of a certain area, and transform it so it becomes a different shape but has the same area. There's an ancient challenge on that. It's called squaring the circle, which means how do you create a circle that has the exact same area as a given square using only a ruler and protractor. And it's impossible to do because pi is an irrational number. But throughout his life, you see Leonardo looking at ways to visualize that and to approximate the squaring of the circle in mathematical ways. You also see his mirror script, because he wrote from right to left, because he was left-handed. And as always, there's a list of questions he wants to know. They describe the tongue of the woodpecker, ask so-and-so, his friend, how I would measure the size of the sun. And now he's turning 30 here, good-looking, as I said. And what I love is at the very bottom, there's a recipe for boiling the husks of nuts in oil, certain types of nuts, in order to make what he calls a tawny hair dye. There he is, turning 30, and worrying a little bit about going gray. He also, as I said, was gay, and he has his first male companion, Salai, who's, as one of the people of the time said, whose curly hair Leonardo luxuriated in. We watched Salai over the years as a steady companion in the notebooks he gets older. But at that time, that unnerving time of becoming a 30-year-old, Leonardo decides he needs to seek new horizons. It's partly, perhaps, because his father had been the notary on the contracts for Adoration of the Magi, St. Jerome, those ones he didn't finish. And as the father of a 20-something, I know what it's like when a 20-something doesn't quite finish a project and, you know, you were helping push it. So maybe there's a little tension there. He's also just wants to be known as more than a painter. So he becomes part of a cultural delegation in 1482, February, sent by Lorenzo de' Medici to Milan in order as a sort of cultural diplomats in order to spread the influence of Florence to Milan. Because Florence was one of the most influential, was the most influential city-state at that time in Italy. But it wasn't because it had a great military. In fact, it was able to lose battles to Pisa twice during Leonardo's lifetime, which is kind of like losing to the New York Giants or something. It's hard to do. But Lorenzo de' Medici decides that he wants an alliance with Milan, and he sends a big cultural delegation led by a poet and playwright. It has artists, architects, you know, painters. And Leonardo da Vinci goes as a musician, because part of his theatrical stuff was he loved how waves worked. He loved how sound waves worked. And so he invented musical instruments, including an acoustical style lira da braca, sort of a violin, lyre for the arm, in the shape of a horse's head that he brings to Milan. But when he gets there, he doesn't really want to go back to Florence. He wants these new horizons. So he writes one of the coolest job application letters in history. It's 11 paragraphs long, and we still have the draft in his notebooks. And the first 10 paragraphs are mainly engineering feats. He writes, "I can design great weapons of war." He says, "I can divert the course of rivers. I can build castles. I can make great public buildings." It's only in the 11th paragraph, as an afterthought, does he say, "I can also paint." And he becomes then the engineer and artist, among many others, in the court of the Duke of Milan. Now, that's a really cool court. Once again, it's a place where people of diverse talents come together and collaborate on various things. His best friend is Luca Pacioli, a mathematician, and Leonardo illustrates his book, Divine Proportion, and understands the notion of divine proportion in math and in art. His other best friend is Donato Bramante, an architect. Anyway, a whole bunch of them decide they're going to work on the Milan Cathedral and to build a tiburio, or a lantern tower, on top of the cathedral there. This is another tale that shows that things that we think are lone acts of genius are often collaborative. Leonardo and his friends, especially Bramante, believe that, like Steve Jobs believed, that simplicity was the soul of beauty. As you look at Milan Cathedral, you're thinking, this is not the soul of beauty. But they design a simple square and circle and octagonal lantern tower. And the authorities don't build it. Instead, they build a Gothic monstrosity. But it allows this group of friends, led by Leonardo and Donato Bramante, to decide to figure out the perfect proportions of a temple or a church and how it comports with the proportions of a human. How do we fit in? Connecting us to the earth, but also to the spirit of creation. We know what they look like because Donato Bramante actually paints a picture of himself, round face and balding, with his good friend Leonardo, with the left, the right to left writing in the notebooks, the pink and purple short tunics that Leonardo loved, well-proportioned athletic body, chiseled face, and the long, curling, luxurious blonde or dyed blonde hair. So they go off and they decide they're going to work on churches that capture the spirit of creation and reflect the proportions of a human. These are Leonardo's drawings. And they also learn, or they know of, a manuscript that has been rediscovered, a few copies of which have been rediscovered, from an ancient architect named Vitruvius. Now, the Renaissance, as you know, was largely the rebirth of classical wisdom. Stephen Greenblatt writes The Swerve about how Lucretius is rediscovered, and that helps the humanism. Well, for them, it was, for Leonardo and his friends, it was Vitruvius, the ancient architect. And Vitruvius writes about the proportions of a human and how they're reflected in the proportions of a proper, simple temple or church. And Vitruvius makes all sorts of lists of every proportion of a human. And Leonardo, never one to accept received wisdom, makes his own list and drawings of every proportion of a human body. 230 of them are from the chin to the lips to the nose to the breastbone, all making his assistants, you know, stand and squat and run, and as he's making all of these measurements. And at the same time, he and his friend Luca Pacioli are still trying to square the circle. There's just page after page of Leonardo's notebooks of, maybe if I do a loon, which is sort of a crescent, and put it in a square, et cetera, et cetera. So they go down to the town of Pavia, right near Milan, where in the castle is a copy of the manuscript of Vitruvius's book on architecture. And they're building a new church there, and it's done along the lines that Leonardo and Bramante want. Nice and simple and beautiful. And then when they go see the manuscript, there's a dinner that they have one July day afterwards. And they're all talking about the manuscript of Vitruvius and exactly how the proportions of a human would be reflected in the proper proportions of a church. And we think Leonardo's Vitruvian Man is this thing he did alone. No, you know, you're able to find, and I was able to find even more, drawings of all of his friends who are doing it that month. They're all trying to figure out, how do you illustrate the man as a proportion of the creation and of the spirit of the church and of the earth. And then Leonardo does it. Yeah. It's in a class by itself. It's not only, it's a work of great science. You can see every proportion is exactly right. With the foot is the measurement rod, and every proportion of the body is done according to the measurements Leonardo has made. It's also a cool work of math, because Leonardo has read, it's part of Vitruvius, that the navel is supposed to be at the center of the earth. But Vitruvius also talks about the genitals being at the center of creation. And so what Leonardo does is he takes a square and a circle, puts a circle on the exact same base as the square. But he has the circle come up higher than the square exactly enough so that the navel can be at the center of the circle and the genitals at the center of the square. And in so doing, he has squared the circle. Made a square the same size as the circle, as if it's a divine proportion done by the proportions of a human and the proportions of spirit. But besides being a great work of art and of science and math, it's also a staggering piece of art. It's a drawing of almost unnecessary beauty. I mean, remember what his friends are doing, you know, crummy little stick figures almost. But Leonardo, when you look at it, it's a left-handed crosshatch shadings, doing a perfectly chiseled and beautiful body, the hands, everything exactly gorgeous, more than you need to illustrate Vitruvius. And then, of course, there's the stair. This amazing stair. When I saw it on the fourth floor of the Academy in Venice, and you see the protractor point right in the navel, and how cleanly and sharply he's done the square, and then you look at the eyes, and he's staring at you with emotion, and then, of course, your mind goes back to what Leonardo looked like. You go back to Bramante or the other paintings, and you say, oh, my goodness, it's actually a self-portrait. It's Leonardo standing naked in the earth, and in the cosmos, saying, how do I fit in to creation? Everything he does has that connection of science to the art, the visual display of information. He starts his anatomy in order to get his art right, but then, being Leonardo, he keeps drilling down, so to speak. So he's doing things not just for the sake of art, not for the sake of being useful, but for curiosity's sake. He's even doing maps that he does for Cesare Borgia and Niccolo Machiavelli that shows how you can do aerial views in the visual displays of information. And all of it, the theater, the art, the science, the visual display of information, also come together in his art. When you see The Last Supper, at first, you know, you think of the beauty of it, but then you realize it's basically a theatrical stage set. I mean, it's like, okay, everybody get on this side of the table if you want to be in the picture. You see the wall. You see the perfect perspective with the vanishing point being in the forehead of Jesus and all the lines going out mathematically correctly from that vanishing point. And yet the walls go back a little too fast. I mean, that's an accelerated perspective. And you're thinking, but then you realize it's like a theater designer would do. When you're doing the scenery on a stage and it comes in like that, he's doing a theater set. And even the picture is not just a moment, but it's a theatrical drama. And would you imagine the monks coming in from the door, and they first see the hand of Jesus go up the arm, and it's as if it's the beginning of a sequence in the Bible, which Jesus is saying, one of you shall betray me. And Leonardo loves the ripple of sound, knows it's like the ripple of water. And so it first gets to these disciples, the trio on each side, and they're saying, the next verse, is it I, Lord? Am I the one? And then it ripples on out to they're just hearing it, and even bounces back as Jesus gets to the next verse, he that dippeth his hand. And you see Judas recoiling as he dippeth his hand with him. And finally, the last part of the dramatic scene, as Jesus reaches for the bread and wine and the institution of the Eucharist. Now, all of this is beautiful as narrative and as art and as science, but there are certain anomalies. Like, all right, here are the three windows, and Leonardo knows a whole lot about light, so why is the light shining on the wall and on the table this way? That's not the way it would look coming in from the windows. And Leonardo would know that. So then you visit it, actually in the refectory in Milan. And as you get there, you see how the perspective works and how amazing it is in the room. But then you also notice up here the window in the upper left, the only window in the dining room. And you suddenly realize that what he's doing is showing the light as if it's coming from the real window and hitting the wall and the table in the painting. Once again, always mixing fantasy and reality in the sake of a great dramatic scene. This is also done in the painting that I hope one of you bought, but doubt you did, because it really could be at the amazing art museum you have here, which is Salvador Mundi, that a couple of weeks ago went for $450 million. I write about it quite a bit in the book, not knowing it was going to go on sale, because I was fascinated about the connection of art and science. Leonardo always believed that, and one of his contributions to art, is the notion of sfumato, the blurring of lines, as if the dissipating of smoke. He realizes we have two eyes, our retinas are large, that if I'm looking at any of you, you're looking at me, there is no sharp line in nature. There's no clean delineation. We don't see things in sharp lines the way Michelangelo would paint. But Jesus' hand, and if you see it in my book or you see it in person, if you're lucky, is incredibly sharp. Why is that? Well, Leonardo, at this time, 1500, is also in his notebooks writing a treatise on perspective. He talks about distance perspective and, you know, mathematical perspective, how things recede, get smaller in the distance, like in The Last Supper. Even artificial perspective he talks about. But then he has a section called acuity perspective, or sharpness perspective. And what he says is that, you know, if something's at a distance, the lines are slightly sfumato and blurred, or really up close. But there's a certain point, maybe at arm's length or so, where our eyes focus and things are really sharp. And so by making this hand very sharp, it makes it look like it's coming out of the panel and is almost ready to touch us as it's blessing us. It was another of the great contributions, which is how to make something look three-dimensional on a two-dimensional panel. And then there's the orb, a perfect piece of crystal. Inclusions, everything there. But there's something strange about the orb, which people hadn't noticed, but I kind of wrote about it and then asked around about it. When you see the painting, and I had the chance to see it a few times in person, the robes of Jesus are just perfectly undistorted right there. Now think about a glass orb or some, you know, souvenir you'd buy at a souvenir shop that has, you know, take a glass and put your finger behind it. Something like that distorts or refracts or even inverts what's behind it, like a lens would. Why does Leonardo not do this? Well, when I first started asking, why is it that way? You know, some art critics said, well, maybe he just didn't know. And I'm thinking, that is ridiculous. Ever since he was 12 years old, he is doing how light hits curved mirrors or lenses and can be focused in order to solder copper balls and everything. He has done more discoveries of optics and lenses, so he knows. Another explanation is he knew that if he made the robes distorted, it would be distracting. It's a beautiful picture, but that would just look ugly if you had the robes kind of. The explanation I actually like, though, is that he knew it would distort the robes, and he knew that there were some viewers who would also know it would distort the robes. But this is a painting of Salvador Mundi, Christ's Savior of the World, and he's trying to show the miraculous quality of his stewardship of this world, that nothing he touches is distorted. He did not have a good relationship with Michelangelo, who was very reclusive, didn't have many friends. And in his notebooks, Leonardo is on the committee to figure out where to put David. And Leonardo insists that they put a decent ornament, meaning a fig leaf, brass fig leaf, which is weird because Leonardo was not that prudish about nudity. But for the first 40 years, they display the statue of David with a brass fig leaf ornament over it. He also had a different painting style. I mean, this is Leonardo's sfumato, you know, blurred line techniques. This is Michelangelo's paintings. He painted like a sculptor where even people in the distance are done very sharply delineated. Leonardo said it made them look like a sack of nuts. So they definitely did not get along. But Leonardo applies all of these things back to his science as well. As I said, the swirling of liquids, his favorite pattern in nature, we see him doing it as he dissects the heart. And he does, you know, a lot of heart dissections. And he discovers the heart valve is a thin membrane. And people thought that the heart valve opened and shut because the pressure coming out of the heart as the blood goes into the aorta opens the valve. And then when the blood's in the aorta, it pushes it back down. Leonardo is here explaining that that would crumple the valve, and even shows an experiment showing it. And he says it's not because of the pressure up and down, but because when liquids go from a larger chamber to a smaller one and hit a side, they form the spiral, and the spiral spreads out the membrane of the heart valve. This happens to be correct. And this is 40 years ago when they're finally doing it with MRI imaging and things like that in Houston. That's how they do the first artificial heart valves, as they realize it has to be opened by the spiral. Now, the other thing I love is those little things that show he's human. This is the very last page of his heart dissections during that period. He's done, you know, just different cross sections. And finally, he starts drawing another part of the heart. And being Leonardo, he gets distracted. He doesn't finish, but he sketches his companion Salai with the heart inside of him, which I thought was slightly endearing. But everything he does is connecting art to science, to engineering, to say, here we are, and how do we fit in? And often with the swirls of water, from the childhood looking at how does water flow into a pond and why does it form spirals, what happens when water goes past an obstacle, how does it form, you know, swirls like that. He even does a way to divert the Arno River with Machiavelli, finally as a way to beat Pisa without having to fight them militarily, is divert the river, because in the 1490s, Vespucci's cousin and Columbus have just sailed across the ocean, and Florence realizes it needs to be a seaport. These are things you and I can try to be more like Leonardo. Every day now, when I look at water flowing into, you know, the sink or the basin in the bathroom, I look and see at the swirls and the bubbles and how they work and how Leonardo got it. Even as an old man, he's doing it. And it culminates with the greatest painting ever. Leonardo, as I said, had done dissections of the human eye and knew that we see things on different parts of the retina. The center of the retina sees detail of black and white best. Edges of the retina, the cones and fovea there, see color and shadow better. Leonardo also, as I said, has dissected the human face over and over again, every muscle that touches the lips and moves it, and every nerve that controls each muscle, whether it goes to the brain, he discovers, or the spinal cord, because he wants to show how inner emotions are shown with outward expressions. Going through the spinal cord, the nervous system, to the muscles, to the lips, he discovers things that you and I could discover that are somewhat mundane, but we don't think about, like the bottom lip is a muscle on its own, the top lip is not, so you can pout your bottom lip by itself, and you can move both lips by, you know, but you can't just move your top lip and pout it. I see a few of you trying it. It's not a pretty, wait till you get home, do it in private. But on this final page of his lip dissection drawings, he takes out a piece of chalk and sketches in 1503 what will become the most famous smile ever painted. He never delivers this to the cloth merchant, as you might expect. He keeps it with him for 16 years, putting layer after layer of tiny glaze brush strokes, glaze meaning oil with very little pigment, so that it builds up over the white primer coat, and the light goes in and bounces off different parts in different layers, depending on how you're looking at it. And it also, of course, has the river coming from the ancient eons of time, connecting us to the roads of civilization and connecting to the veins of our body, saying, here's how we fit in. And then, of course, there's the smile, in which every muscle and everything is anatomically beautiful. And there's many, many layers, so it looks slightly different depending on where you're looking from. And also on the corners here, the tiniest black and white details actually go down a little bit, or straight here, but the colors and shadows go up, which means it's an interactive smile, a virtual reality. It changes depending on how strongly you're looking at it. The more you look at the smile, the more elusive it becomes. It has a changing emotions. If you're staring directly at it, she suddenly may not seem like she's smiling, but then you go to her forehead or her chin or her cheek, or your eyes wander, your head shifts, and the mysterious smile comes back on. It's as if she has many inner emotions, and they change. And so too do our emotions as we look at her. And as we change, she seems to change. It is an absolute triumph of art, of science, and of somebody who had spent a whole lot of time squandered on optics and science and anatomy and geology and understanding everything about how we fit into creation. He starts it in Florence in 1503. He brings it to Milan with him. He takes it to Rome for a while. And finally, Francis I, the King of France, as Leonardo is dying in his final years in his 60s, his heart is failing, but invites him to come to France. And he brings it by mule over the Alps to the Banner House in France. next to the Chateau of the King. And there it is by his bed for the last year or so of his life as he's still trying to perfect it. When I did Einstein, I decided I wanted to study his last notebook page just to see, you know, somebody who's fixated on things, how they always care about it. And on his deathbed in Princeton, Einstein, his last night, his aorta had burst. He decided not to have an operation. He knows he's not going to make it much longer. But he just writes 9 more pages of equations trying to get to the unified theory, a unified field theory that would connect the laws of gravity to electromagnetism, basically relativity to quantum theory. He knows he's not going to get there. By the way, it's been more than 100 years. I mean, it's been more than 60 years. We still haven't gotten a unified theory. But that's what he did. That's what he wanted to do. And finally, the very last line dribbles off as he's trying to write one last line of equations that would get him closer to the spirit of the universe. And so, too, with Leonardo, I looked at his last notebook page. There he is in France. And he's still trying to figure out ways to square the circle. He's doing some trick of Euclid, which has right triangles of different length legs, and how you can shade it, and then you would make a square around it, and then you could use that to... And he has a chart explaining what he's doing. He knows he's not going to get that much closer to squaring the circle, but that's what he's doing at the end. And then the very bottom of the page, as he's describing how you would try to do it, it breaks off right here and then says, but the soup is getting cold. You can imagine him upstairs in his room. Salai is downstairs, and Melzi and other companions, and his cook, Maturin, is there. And Leonardo is still trying, even as he knows he'll never make it, doing one last attempt to get us closer to the spirit manifest in the laws of the universe. But the soup is getting cold. Thank you all. We have time for a couple of questions, I guess. I know we also want to sign some books, so I'll try to be shorter in the answers than I was in my talk.
Thank you for that brilliant discourse. Did he have a family life?
Well, he had his companion Salai, I've talked about, and later in life he has another companion, moves on to a more aristocratic man named Melzi, who inherits the notebooks and everything else. And he had a retinue around him of, you know, friends, retainers, a household. I mean, he had a studio, he had a cook, they all lived together, including at the end in France. We know for the first time who his mother is. It's been sort of lost to history. People thought she might have been like an Arab slave or whatever. But a couple of researchers, and it's in my book, the conclusion is, you know, she was Caterina Lippi, a orphaned girl from the village of Vinci. And she comes and moves in with him near the end of her life, as she's very old. And he writes about her, and even we know how much they spend on candles for her funeral. So he was close to his father till the end. He was close to his mother. He had a lot of stepbrothers, and he had this family, but the family was about 15 or so people in his entourage who he shopped for, who Maturin cooked for at the end. And so, but he never had, you know, a conventional family.
Thank you. Are the notebooks, the codexes, available either online, or can one see one or more of them in their original places?
It's a very good question, because the answer is no, and it puzzles me. You can go online and see maybe some of the notebooks, but not all. I mean, it seems to me, and I was just puzzled. I mean, year after year, I mean, I keep Googling it and saying, okay, there must be one place that has all of his notebooks, but there isn't. They aren't gathered anywhere, either online or physically. They go on display every now and then. I mean, I've seen them all in, like, the Biblioteca Ambrosiana in Milan is where the flight of birds. Bill Gates' house in Seattle, he has a Codex Lester. So you can, you know, there are places, but they're often on tour, like at the Morgan Library in New York last year. The Codex on the Flight of Birds was done up at Boston Museum of Fine Arts a year ago. You know, it was just other notebook pages. Windsor Castle is where the anatomy drawings are, including fetus in the womb, and they're very rarely displayed. I would like to try to figure out, I haven't done this yet, but, you know, maybe in a year or two, figure out how we can get everybody to work together. And Bill Gates is going to have a new translation of the Codex Lester published next year. He was nice enough that his curator and translators and all gave me early access to what they're going to do. So someday I hope all the notebooks are available. They're just cool to look at.
Do you think there are any undiscovered paintings of Da Vinci and or misattributed?
Yes, both. You know, famously, you know, Salvador Mundi gets rediscovered. Still a tiny bit of controversy around it, but I'm absolutely convinced that it was basically a Leonardo painting. We know Leonardo painted a Salvador Mundi. We know it was in the British royal family until the 1760s when the British royal family was even ditzier than it is now and somehow lost it, and it wasn't cataloged after that. So that is probably a true reappearance. We also had a drawing he did, La Bella Principessa, that was rediscovered and authenticated about 15 years ago. Beginning of the century, there was, beginning of 1900, I mean, there was another rediscovery. There's like 15 paintings that we know that he pretty much finished and that were pretty much surely his, and which is not a big set of works. There's probably one or two whose attributions are, you know, disputable, particularly a Madonna and Child. You know, there are a couple of those that it's not clear whether he or his workshop did it. It doesn't mean they're forgeries. It just means they were done in the workshop without much of Leonardo's brushstrokes. There are a few paintings that are lost, like Leda and the Swan. We know the prep drawings. We know copies that his students made. It is possible someday Leda and the Swan will be rediscovered somewhere. I think maybe there's only one or two that we know did exist, and we have no idea if they still exist. Yes?
You mentioned Da Vinci's fascination by the swirling water. Mm-hmm. Was he ever south of the equator and saw the water go in the opposite direction?
One of the odd things about Leonardo, he didn't travel that much. The only time he's ever out of Italy is at the end of his life when he goes to France.
Thank you. Who would you say were his influences? Who would he? Was there any documentation that he had influences that he looked to?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the great thing, in fact, some of you may know of Anthony Grafton. I'll give him a shout-out. Great professor at Princeton of Alberti is one of the people he writes about. And he actually reviews my biography this coming Sunday in the New York Times Book Review, which I've now seen online. And I don't know Professor Grafton, but it's a wonderful review. I want to know Professor Grafton now. And it only has one criticism in it, which is a very valid criticism, but buried in the piece, is that I don't spend enough time describing the influences on Leonardo that came before him, including Alberti, which is the person whom Professor Grafton has written about, Brunelleschi, who did the dome. What's happening in Florence then is there's suddenly a discovery of all sorts of art and engineering and science, like perspective. I mean, Leonardo's great, as I said, doing a treatise on perspective, even the acuity perspective, but so did Alberti. He wrote about perspective, and there's a famous, you know, looking at the doors of the baptistry and cutting a hole through it and doing a mirror and doing a painting behind it and how you would test the perspective. All of those things are happening in Florence. And that's a sort of a good lesson to end on, which is there are times and places
where there's just a lot of creative influence happening. You see it in 1470s in Florence. You see it exactly 500 years later in the 1970s in the Bay Area of California, when everything from the hippies and the free speech movement and the electric Kool-Aid acid test, as well as the engineers of Intel and Westinghouse and NASA and the invention of the microchip become sort of the homebrew computer club, mixing free spirit and power to the people with power to the computers and computers to the people. And all of that is happening in a very tolerant, very mixed up environment in which a Steve Jobs moves on down to the Bay Area. You see that happening a few times in history. One of the cool things that we're seeing now, and I'll leave on an optimistic note, because there's a lot going on now that perhaps a few of you are thinking, this is not the best moment we're going through as a nation. But if you leave Washington, as I have now done, to move back to New Orleans, and you go to a place like New Orleans, or a place like Philadelphia, or Detroit, or Cleveland, or Chattanooga, or Austin, or I can name 30 cities. There are cities now where creativity, technology, entrepreneurship, and startup mentalities have created a sort of creative culture in the heart of cities, people moving back into them, even Detroit. Philadelphia has always had this, but there has been a movement back into a more creative core of the city. And, you know, I like to think it's happening in New Orleans. We know it's happening in Detroit. But I'm stunned every now and then to find it's happening, say, in Chattanooga, let us say, a small town. There are places where it's not happening. You know, I can name other cities in Tennessee. I mean, it's happening in Nashville, it's happening in Chattanooga, but there are other places it's not. Same with Ohio. And so one of the questions is how we're becoming two nations, one in which creative types and entrepreneurial spirits are moving into creative zip codes, and they tend to vote differently than the people one county over who are not part of the success and happiness of a meritocratic, creative influx. And we have to nurture these centers of creativity. And the reason it's moved out of Silicon Valley and into places like this is that it's no longer driven just by engineering. I mean, the digital revolution in the 70s was driven by, basically, by engineers. But now it's about connecting things to technology. Whether I was just in Houston, connecting the energy industry to technology and big data. Here in Philadelphia, it's connecting the health sciences with technology. In places like Chattanooga, it's like connecting the arts and, you know, maker, do-it-yourself, cool things with technology. In New Orleans, it's about music and, you know, that type of creativity, how it connects and creates things in a digital age. And so if there are lessons to be learned from Leonardo, you know, it's always stay incredibly curious, always be observant, let fantasy mix with your reality, but also realize it's not about being a specialist just in the engineering. It's about the connections you can make across the patterns of nature. And I love coming back to a Philadelphia, and I love coming to places in which you have that creative spirit, entrepreneurial spirit, and even the economy that goes with a startup type spirit or, you know, business-like spirit that can connect to it. And that's the hope of our country, is that even as Washington remains dysfunctional, we're seeing these little Florences spring up all over the country. Thank you all.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.